Hello, everybody. Earl Green here, webmaster of thelogbook.com. I'm here to talk you through the first episode of the new series of Doctor Who, for those of you who are seeing it for the first time. Just to clarify a little bit, I am not in any way associated with the show, nor do I claim to be or claim to have any copyright to it. I'm just a fan, and I run a little website, and I love this show. I seriously love this show, both the original and the new one. And so I thought it would be handy to talk casual viewers and new viewers through the new series, point out connections to the old, and probably do just a little bit of retconning at the same time. Also, just a word of fair warning here. I do not know how Sci-Fi Channel is going to carve this show up for commercial breaks. I'm doing this from the Canadian DVD set, and so there are no commercial breaks. So when they go to break, just pause me and shut me up, assuming you haven't done so by the first commercial break anyway. This new series was basically willed into existence by Russell T. Davies, who is also one of the producers. He had previously written a novel for Virgin Publishing's New Adventures range, Doctor Who New Adventures range, called Damaged Goods, and was very well regarded. Davies is also best known for creating the original British version of Queer as Folk, quite different from the Showtime version in the US, as well as Bob and Rose and a few other things. The name Rose seems to be a recurring theme with Davies for some odd reason. These scenes are kind of interesting because we establish here that, unlike past sidekicks of the Doctor, Rose actually does not have an entirely dysfunctional life. So it's interesting to see the companion resume the role of, you know, sort of every person, you know, as opposed to being someone who has been through some unfathomable tragedy that the audience might not have the easiest time connecting with. Have to forgive me my perpetual head cold, sorry about that. Billy Piper was a surprising choice. I remember a lot of snide comments around the time that she was cast, or even at the time that she was discussed as being a possibility for the role of Rose. As it turns out, I think she was a good choice. If you're just now watching the new show for the first time, she'll probably grow on you. Rose also has a prominence that is unusual for companion characters in television Doctor Who, because the companions have normally served a function, traditionally, all the way back to the show's premiere in 1963. The companions were the audience's advocates. When the companions don't understand what's going on, they ask the Doctor what's happening, and that usually coincides with what the audience is asking as well. However, there usually wasn't much more depth to the characters than that, whereas with Rose, we become well acquainted with her family and friends, and they recur throughout the season. Probably notice a lot of mannequins here. We're about to do something sinister, which, by the way, I am probably going to take the same tack here as the lovely Battlestar Galactica podcasts do, and I am by no means implying that this is on the same level as those. I'm going to assume that you have already watched the show once without me gibbering over it, and so it's safe for me to go ahead and spoil things. The mannequins here are actually a returning enemy who had not been seen since the early 70s. Their names are never actually given on screen, although they are credited in the end credits as Autons. The Autons date back to the very first color episode of Doctor Who in 1970, Spearhead from Space. That episode's also available on DVD if you're curious. They appeared once again the following year in the first story to introduce the Master, which was Terror of the Autons. And yes, the running theme is that they are mannequins, shop dummies, and that they move around and try to kill people, and they have weapons in their hands. The Autons are controlled by a life form called the Nestine Consciousness, who we'll run into later. It's interesting to note that every time the Nestine shows up, not only does it sound like a refreshing drink, but it takes on a different physical form every time. However, it makes a little bit of sense if it is a non-corporeal life form seeking a physical body. In Spearhead from Space in 1970, it appeared to be something rather octopus-like in a large fish tank, whereas in Terror of the Autons, it appeared as a large squid materializing over a satellite dish in the English countryside. Not something you see every day. The Nestine we'll see later on in this episode is completely different altogether. However, it's just possible that if it's non-corporeal, and the usual running theme is that its Autons are working on finding or creating a body for it to inhabit, it'll take whatever form is handy. Obviously, the Doctor has learned a great deal from Ace here as he's making his own homemade explosives. He's so gleeful about it. I really liked Christopher Eccleston in this role. Enjoyed him tremendously. I thought he was a smashing Doctor. After years and years of hearing stunt casting rumors like Eric Idle and David Hasselhoff, not that I have anything against Eric Idle, and not that I really do have anything against David Hasselhoff, I guess I should make that point. I just never envisioned either of them as Doctor Who, whereas I think Eccleston was an inspired choice. I'll talk to you about acceptable safety standards later. And coming up here, oh, what's that? First glimpse we see of the TARDIS in the new series. It's a running theme in Russell Davies' dramatic work, at least that I have seen so far. I have to admit I have not seen the original Queer as Folk, but I have seen a 2003 miniseries that he did for ITV in Britain called The Second Coming, which also starred Christopher Eccleston. And a running theme of Davies' work, and this continues to play out later this season in an episode called Aliens of London, a running theme seems to be the influence and the reaction of the media to certain events. Alas, poor Mickey. Don't judge him too harshly on this first episode. This character does develop, and Noel Clark finds whole new ways to play the character other than as a comic foil. And he becomes very interesting later on. I'm quite a big fan of Noel and Mickey here. And he's very disarming. There's a lot of question in 2003, when the new series was first announced, over whether the new Doctor Who would be a continuation of the original series, carrying on forward from its mythology, or a reboot. A reboot basically would jettison the entire 26 years of mythology of the original series, and I'm just counting televised stories there, You may or may not know that Doctor Who has carried on in other media, much as the Star Trek franchise has. However, Doctor Who has expanded into audio plays, of which I'm quite a big fan of the Big Finish audio plays, as well as novels and fan-made videos, which is something the Star Trek fandom is really now beginning to seriously get into. And it's about time, because some of the fan-made Doctor Who spin-offs, they're quite clever in that they don't have the copyright to use the Doctor himself. At least the commercially released ones don't. But the way British copyright law works, you can get the rights to use, for example, K-9 from the writers who created K-9. Now, if the characters were a staff-created character, especially for the show, created by the show's producers, then that belongs to the BBC. So, Rose and the Doctor belong to the BBC, K-9, the Sontarans, the Cybermen, the Daleks. You can actually negotiate with their individual creators, or their creators' estates in some cases, sadly, for the rights to use those characters. And the it'll be interesting to see what Star Trek fandom makes of the fan video phenomenon. I have to admit here, and I will say no more of this because I'm sure this will be a disturbing revelation, I find Rose's mom here much more attractive than Rose herself. That's all. Thank you. I've embarrassed myself satisfactorily. Getting back to the continuation versus reboot debate, it is interesting how Russell Davies has managed to make the show accessible to a new audience, and how, because this was voted the number one drama in the UK last year by viewers, so he must be doing something right. And yet, at the same time, for the longtime fans, there is something for everyone. It may not be overt, but the Autons show up, UNIT shows up, and the Daleks show up, and I much prefer the continuation route. It's not a complete reinvention from the ground up, like, say, Battlestar Galactica. From an acting standpoint, I cannot imagine how silly that must have been. While I'm sitting here groping for something to say, just thought I'd point out that if you do like these podcasts, give me a shout, earl@thelogbook.com. I'd just like to know if anyone's listening. In the background over here on the these blue doors, if you look real close, you will catch a glimpse of a phrase that will come back to haunt you later in the series, Bad Wolf. Bad Wolf actually is seen or heard in every episode of this season, and there's a reason for that, and I'm not going to tell you what it is. I like this really lighthearted approach to the character of the Doctor. I mean, Christopher Eccleston plays this in a way that it does pay homage to previous Doctors whose portrayals have not been entirely serious, such as Patrick Troughton, Sylvester McCoy, Tom Baker. And yet he also does the mad, bad, and dangerous to know things so well, which became a hallmark of, well, all the way back to William Hartnell, really. and everything that the doctor warns Rose about with regard to the Autons here and later in the episode does track with the original series. We later get into things like Shadow Proclamations and the War, which are not necessarily a feature of the original series as televised, but we'll talk more about those as they get closer. It's interesting to note that later on in this episode, we do start seeing the interior of the TARDIS almost every time the door is open, which is a neat trick. It's not always something that was done in the original series. It's something that was never done in the original series, actually. But it's interesting to note that until we get to the reveal shot of the interior, we fall back on the original series trick of the interior just looking like a police box. It's also interesting that it seems like when the TARDIS appears and disappears in the new series, there seems to be some displacement of air, which, if you're going to try to rationalize how it works, it makes some sense that something suddenly ripping through space and time and appearing where there had been something like, 25 square feet of air before, the air has to go somewhere. Searchwise.net is actually run by a prop renter in the UK. Basically what it is it's a made-up search engine that you can use if you are doing a film or television production and you want specific results to come up, which would be rather difficult to do with Google, for example. And so you can employ the Searchwise.net owners to create something that will come up with the results you want. It's actually a real site, and you can actually go there, but it's not a real search engine. And here we are about to meet Clive. Who is played by... I'm going to have to look him up. He is played by Mark Benton, who is also... He was also in The Second Coming, which starred Christopher Eccleston, was written by Russell T. Davies, and scored by Murray Gold. So you start to get the sense that there's sort of an RTD repertoire company, which isn't entirely uncommon. There are people like David Lynch who have these consistent stables of actors they always seem to call on. In The Second Coming, basically, Christopher Eccleston has a strange experience and then wakes up declaring that he is the Son of God one day. And later on in the miniseries, Mark Benton here plays a... Basically, he plays the devil. not a man possessed by the devil, just the devil, who happens to be living in Manchester. Work that one out for yourself. But in that role, Mark Benton is extremely, he's actually extremely unnerving. It's a very disturbing performance and carried off very well. So I was thrilled to hear very early on that Mark Benton was going to be in the new show. However, some of the early announcements about his involvement seemed to imply that he was going to be an ongoing character. And so when I first saw this episode and saw who his character was, I was a little dismayed, and later on, for reasons that will become clear later, obviously the character is not going to be recurring, which is a good thing, because here it's almost like he's the Doctor's watcher. Perhaps more in a Highlander sense than a Buffy the Vampire Slayer sense. But I was kind of relieved to see that the idea of the Doctor having a watcher, even if it's not called that, was left out for the remainder of the season. I mean, of course there are people who are always watching out for his appearance, but I'm glad we didn't have Clive as a running character, not any slight intended toward the actor Mark Benton, who I enjoyed tremendously, and I'd actually like to see him show up in the series again in some other capacity, because he still has a little bit of an unnerving conspiracy freak thing going on here. Reasons I would not want to see a Watcher-type character in Doctor Who is that it would stand the chance of making the show look less than original. Which certainly would not serve Doctor Who very well. That said, however, Russell Davies and Julie Gardner and several other people associated with the making of the show have said time and again in interviews, that their frame of reference for the pacing and the style of storytelling for the new Doctor Who is, in fact, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And that confirms a theory that I've had for a few years now, that once we have some distance from the 1990s, and we can more objectively analyze what influenced what, and, you know, what various entertainment franchises created trends that were followed by others, I think the most influential sci-fi series of the 90s are going to wind up being Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Babylon 5, and Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks, just for the serialized Mysterioso style of storytelling, which I would argue very strongly that you can see Twin Peaks in current shows such as Lost or Invasion. Babylon 5, I really would dearly like to say that its influence will be the ongoing story arc phenomenon. However, I don't think it will be remembered for that, because I believe that Joss Whedon, Ronald Moore, and others have carried that forward and carried that serialized style forward to a new level. And, you know, no disrespect toward J. Michael Straczynski, but sadly what Babylon 5 will probably be remembered for best is the introduction of computer effects on television. And as for Buffy, the very skillful intermingling of moving the plot forward as well as telling stories about the emotional lives of the characters, I think that is what Buffy's enduring influence will be. Arguably, you could probably include Xena in the most influential sci-fi and fantasy series of the 90s. However, I believe that As much as I liked Xena, I'm actually more of a fan of Xena than I am of Buffy. I think Buffy actually trumps Xena as far as contemporary relevance, and as such, gained a wider audience. I think it's a really funny reversal on Doctor Who tradition that the person who loses it there after someone's head is pulled off and continues to talk is a man. It's an ongoing debate that I don't think will ever be resolved into one satisfactory conclusion or another, that in the past Doctor Who has been perhaps just a little bit sexist. I think the new show goes a long way toward addressing that, but it's a thing that you either just enjoy it on its own merits as a product of the time and just sort of chuckle at it, or you can get really offended about it if you like. Again, notice we did not see inside the TARDIS, even though we were in a perfect position to. I have to say, I love this scene right here. In a way, that is a bit of a riff on Chang Lee venturing into the TARDIS for the first time in the 1996 Doctor Who TV movie, which aired on Fox in the U.S., starring Paul McGann. But just the pace, that was done at a much slower pace, and this one is just at breakneck speed. In some ways, that just makes it funnier. Here we have the interior of the TARDIS conceptualized as far as what the look of the TARDIS in the new series would be by comics artist Brian Hitch. And I think he did a fantastic job. It looks nothing like the TARDIS has before, and yet it maintains some of the basic architectural elements of the previous TARDIS sets. You know, the round indentations on the walls, the central console. And actually, it owes a lot to, again, the 1996 TV movie's TARDIS, which is the first time the Time Rotor really extended up into the ceiling instead of having a finite top of its own. And in some ways, the positioning of the console, the multi-leveled floors, and even the overarching support structures that hold the whole thing together, including the Time Rotor, this almost seems to be the pop-off battle damage panels version of McGann's TARDIS. Same machine, same control room, it's just that it's been through some kind of ordeal, and now it's held together by the Gallifreyan equivalent of spit and baling wire. Now, watch this time. We can see in. It's amazing how the TARDIS can keep its interior from being seen, you know, until the audience is good and ready to see it. It's an interesting thing. The interior set of the TARDIS, the external doors are the opposite side of the police box doors. That has not been done before. In previous versions of the TARDIS console room set, the interior of the TARDIS, you would walk in through these little police box doors, and then you'd get in on the other side, and the doors are these huge interlocking things. And, you know, very high-tech looking. You know, even though in some cases, I recently watched the DVD of the very first episode of Doctor Who broadcast in 1963, including a rejected unaired version of the pilot episode, which, mainly due to some technical flubs, but there was also some rewriting and rethinking of the premise involved. There were some cases where those high-tech doors didn't always open very smoothly. So it's interesting to see that apparently now it's boiled down to just the opposite side of the police box doors, which makes a little more sense. At various points in the 70s and then later on in the 80s, they would get around that by either not showing what's outside the door from the interior set of the TARDIS, or they would move things around and create sort of an anteroom that you would go through between the police box doors and the TARDIS console room doors, which in itself made a sort of sense. But here we finally glue it all together for the first time, and it makes a sort of sense. be ready to hear that word a lot. Fantastic is the Ninth Doctor's catchphrase, and it fits imperfectly. Judging, the only thing we've seen of the Tenth Doctor so far is the Christmas special, the Christmas invasion, and he utters that word once there, and I'm not quite sure it should be a Tenth Doctor catchphrase. It's just so uniquely Eccleston. Really like the actual London location filming. Although I'm quite sure that this hatch that we're seeing is a piece of set dressing that was added on the day. Especially since it's glowing like that from the inside. And here we get our first glimpse of the Nestine, at least as of 2005. Looks a little bit different than he did in 1970. Of course, I'm sure it's probably not the same Nestine. The voice of the Nestine, which occasionally, if you go back and listen carefully, you know, without me talking over it, the Nestine actually speaks fragmented sentences and occasionally says things like Time Lord, which is the first character we hear utter that phrase in the new series is this Nestine creature. The Nestine is voiced by Nicholas Briggs, who is also, for the purposes of the new series, the voice of the Daleks and the Cybermen. And Nicholas Briggs is part of the sort of the Big Finish rep company doing the audios. Actually, how he came to be known by the BBC for doing Dalek voices is he had already done them for a series of audio plays. And so it seems like a lot of the unearthly voice work required, especially anything with a tie to the classic series, which requires a specific style of vocalizing, they go to Nicholas Briggs. He is the man for the job. Getting caught for dummies. Now only $12.99. Interesting that this Nestine has a face. That's slightly different. I have no idea if it's more squid-like underneath there. But again, going back to what I said, if you're non-corporeal and you're looking for a shape to take, just about anything I suppose will do. Now, let's talk about fighting in the war. That's a unique new element of the series, and not something that was in the original series. You know, we've never seen on screen the Doctor fighting in the Time War. Now, that said, it is not a completely unknown concept. In a book called The First Doctor Handbook, which also, I believe the handbooks have also been reprinted by Telos Publishing, telos.co.uk, if you want to go give them a look. The handbooks have been republished in one volume, and I have to say they are possibly the best reference work on Doctor Who. The First Doctor Handbook, written by David J. Howe, Mark Stammers, and Stephen James Walker, reveals a document that was written in 1963 by BBC staff writer C.E. Weber, who was instrumental in the development of the very earliest episodes. And in a document not unlike a series Bible, Weber included the following idea for the doctor, and I quote, "He seems not to remember where he comes from, but he has flashes of garbled memory which indicate that he was involved in a galactic war and still fears pursuit by some undefined enemy." Now, it's important to note that this was being developed for the very first William Hartnell episodes in 1963, and that element was not used in the original series, but it's interesting to see it crop up again now, and almost the same way. Goodbye, Clive. By the way, the handgun, that sound effect is a holdover from 1970. That is the original Auton gun sound effect used in Spearhead from Space. I'm sure it's been digitally remastered, brought up to digital surround spec, but the effect is basically the same. I was stunned to hear that effect return without any amendments or changes or reprocessing, at least not that I could hear, because it's a very 1970s BBC radiophonic workshop sound effect, let's face it. Not that there's anything wrong with that. And so I was pleasantly surprised to see that link to the past make itself heard. Autons are known for popping out of shop windows and terrorizing people. However, the original series only ever managed this on sort of a sleepy Sunday morning scale. Here we see the Auton invasion brought up to more of a Jerry Bruckheimer scale, trashing downtown Cardiff as we go. Now, getting back to the war element, it's interesting to see that it's cropped up again. And also, some fans, at the first mention of the Time War, which we really don't hear it specified as a Time War until the third episode, so hopefully I'm not completely spoiling you here. But there were some fans who really did not dig that idea, because we had had something just like it. Well, not just like it, but we had had the temporal Cold War in Star Trek Enterprise. And as we all know, that worked out so well for Enterprise, with space Nazis, and of which the less said, the better. That said, there was some trepidation about, you know, do we really want to do this in Doctor Who? However, I have a feeling we still have yet to learn more about the Time War, because it's doled out in little breadcrumb segments throughout this first season, and has a lot to do with what has happened to the rest of the Time Lords, the rest of the TARDISes, and Gallifrey, the Doctor's home planet. Special effects on a slightly grander scale than the original series, in case you hadn't noticed. Actually, it's so easy to get on the original show's case about effects and wobbly sets and so on, but it was really the script writing that held it together. The script writing and the performances, which, you know, another favorite British science fiction series of mine, Blake 7, had an even lower budget than Doctor Who, but it was held together by sheer will of the performers. And I think for the most part, the new series does have that in common with the old. However, the special effects certainly don't hurt in bringing it to the attention of a new audience. It's kind of interesting here, when I first saw this, there's just something puckish about how Eccleston plays the Doctor here that made me think of Chris Berry as Rimmer from Red Dwarf. Just something about that self-satisfied little smile I thought was very, very Chris Berry. So we're winding down here on the first episode of Doctor Who. Thanks everybody for listening. I really have not intended this to be any kind of definitive guide. I'm not an Uber fan. I'm sure if any of the heavyweight regulars from Outpost Gallifrey are listening, they're probably wondering, who in the world is this guy? And why is he not singing what I'm thinking right now? That said, I just thought it would be fun to draw some connections between the old series and the new, because there are many, and many of them are background, almost in-jokes. You could miss them if you blink. And so I thought it would be fun to point out these connections, point out that there is a larger continuum and a larger continuity in play. And if you like this show, I think you'll like the original. And so if you just can't handle the wait between episodes, or God help you, between seasons of Doctor Who, believe me, there is plenty more where that came from. And note again, I'm looking at the original credits. I'm sure Sci-Fi is probably going to do squeeze credits for these. The original end credits note that the Autons were created by Robert Holmes. They were not a creation specifically. Well, they were specifically for Doctor Who, but Holmes was a freelance writer at the time, and so he retains the copyright to the Autons. So, again, the BBC had to go to the estate of Robert Holmes to get permission for them to appear. We'll see you again in a few seconds for the second commentary, if you're not sick of me already. Bye-bye. So, Not a completely new thing. So there we have the end of the world, the end of the first night of the new Doctor Who in the United States. I'm delighted that Sci-Fi has brought the show over. Even if they're a little behind the rest of the world, I enjoy being able to tune in and see it. Please, guys, pick up the second season. You know, if you're not going to show us Galactica new episodes until October, feel free to just go ahead and pick up the second season of Doctor Who and slot it in there. I will be more than happy to watch it. So that's the end of the world. I will see you again next week in your timeline. And that's interesting. Alien voices provided by Silas Carson. Silas was also Ki-Adi Mundi in the Star Wars prequels, wasn't he? I don't remember seeing that credit before. I probably have, but it just skipped my mind. In fact, now I'm sure I'm commented on that in the logbook episode guide. Anyway, that's it for this episode, and we will see you again with the next one, The Unquiet Dead. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.